As a primary school, I walked down every night after school to the boat shed. Never went home. That was just down the road. I walked down to the boat shed. I loved the place. I was fascinated by the big timber and the big keels. And I was fascinated by the way they could make them all fit.
For 35 years, Kayser was a name synonymous with strong, well-found fishing boats. Their boats could be found in every port from Melbourne to Adelaide. It all started with Bob Kayser working for Peter Locke.
My grandfather went to work for Peter Locke very early in the piece, and Peter was fishing and building, and Dad left school and went to serve his time with Peter. And so that went on for some time. The war came and my grandfather kept working, but Peter was hardly ever there then. He was fishing all the time. Grandpa was building the boats. And Dad left and went to work in Melbourne during the war. And he worked on the railways. He went there as a carriage builder, believe it or not, because he was a boat builder and worked with the tools. But during the war, they couldn't build carriages, so they put him in on the trains. And he worked on the engines, on the trains. But when he got married, he came back to Point Lonsdale, and Grandpa said to him, "Look, I'm doing all the work here. We should buy the business. We should buy it off Peter." So they did. And
what year would that have been?
That must have been about 1946, late 45, I believe, late 45. It was when Mum and Dad were married. They came back here, and Grandpa and his twin, Uncle John, and Dad bought the business off Peter in the old rundown shed with the old rundown slipway. And so that's where it started, yeah. The very first boat that Dad and Grandpa built was for Doug Warren, who was the local fisherman here. But that he was their very first order for them, and they built that.
And what boat was that?
Oh, I can't remember the name.
Was that the James William?
It might have been the James William, but it was a very early boat for Dugger. He was on his own then. He wasn't in partnership with Charlie Zanoni. But I remember Grandpa said that was the first boat we built for Dugger. And Dugger was always there. He was always a fisherman in Queenscliff and always around. And then it just never stopped. But they were building boats around 30 foot, 35, and of course, Cooter boats all the time. They built a lot of boats for here. Very few boats for the Lawn Pier. And I can just as a small child remember some of those early boats, but not well. But a guy came across from Port Macdonald in South Australia and ordered a boat. And I remember that was about 32, maybe 35 feet. And that was one of the first boats at Port Macdonald because they just really got into crayfishing there. And it wasn't long before they had a few more orders, but they weren't big boats still. They were still building around the 30, almost to 40, but all of a sudden they grew and the boats got bigger. And I remember Bill Patterson got another one built in that time. I think it was the Lewis William. I remember that being built. And then we built another boat for Portland, and Bill came back and got another one because I think that boat we built might have surpassed his. And so all of a sudden we were building, or they were building, lots of big boats. This was before I even started work. And a lot of them were going to South Australia and to Port Macdonald and to Beachport and to Robe. They built two or three boats to Robe.
Yeah, able to name any?
I'm not able to name the boats, but I remember we built the first one, went for Murray Elliott. We built another one that went to Rendlesham. Sid Wallace was further around. Wally Laurie was a bit further around again. Although I think his son is in Robe now, but I'm not sure whether Wally was in Robe in those early
Kingston,
days.
Kingston, I think.
Yeah, Kingston. And then he got another one, and he got another one, and then Sid Wallace got another one. And then we, just before I started, we built a 45, or they built a 45 footer for Keith Williams.
The Pandora.
Yeah, Pandora. And that went to Port Macdonald. Very soon after it arrived at Port Macdonald, we built another one for John Swaffer. And it was just after that that Bill Patterson came back and ordered his new one, and that was 59 feet. And that's when I started work. I started work when that boat was planked, because I remember the first job I had was putting up the nail aisles. And
so that was the biggest boat at that stage.
It was. That. No, it wasn't the biggest that Dad and Grandpa had built. They built a boat called the Loch Lomond. That was 70 feet. So that was the biggest boat that had been in the shed, the Loch Lomond.
But Peter Locke ended up with it.
I think so, yes. But that was quite a long... I don't remember that boat being built. That was a long time before me. And then the boats just... I mean, they'd never stopped building boats.
We have some old footage here, courtesy of the Queenscliff History Museum. Shows a young couple and their two children on a holiday at Queenscliff, obviously. Shows them down at the creek with the boats. It shows a scallop boat there, which dates it pretty well with the old wooden gantry on it, at early 60s. Shows the old Kayser shed with Bob and John outside. A few sound effects. Shows a boat inside the shed. Love to know what boat that was, just about ready to be painted. Little old lady Diane outside on the slip, don't know the history of her. And then there's a few shots of the boats in the creek. There's a few people around who would know what boats they were. There's a Stormalong, but not the Stormalong I knew.
But all of a sudden the boats rolled in like we hadn't seen. I think, yeah, I would have been there when we built John Swaffer's boat. That's right, I was working because we built it alongside of Bill Patterson's boat. We had a 45 and a 59 in the shed at the same time. And we were working on a 32-footer over the far side, which was the forerunner to the scallop boats in the bay. That first scallop boat that came in, that sort of started a whole new thing for us. I mean, we were building cray boats, but all of a sudden people were ordering scallop boats off us, or boats specifically for scalloping.
Which were different in what way from your cray boat?
None, except they came with a different structure on the stern and probably the wheelhouse forward. But they were adapting the boats that were in the bay for scalloping. The guy that came in, Keith Fox, he was the first and he found the scallops over off Sorrento, Portsea. But he did, in fact, order one of our 45-footers later on.
The Warrain.
Yes. And I did see that over in Tasmania many years later, but I don't know where it is now.
She's still knocking about over
there.
Yeah,
I was talking to... We were over at Launceston just a few months ago and I was talking to the guy who was the bosun at the yacht club there, and he knew me or of me, and he knew where a lot of our boats were. And the Pandora was tied up out the front. And I said to him, "Would you have?" Yeah, he said, "The Warrain's further down there," but he wasn't quite sure where it was working.
So there was four or five of them built off the same moulds virtually, the Pandora.
Yeah, Pandora, there was the Swaffers, there was another one that went...
The Patricia?
Yeah, that was John Swaffer, Patricia.
The Barbara Joan for Roy Bubb?
Yeah, Barbara Joan.
I had the Barbara Joan for 5 years, bought her off Roy Bubb, 1970. She was a good strong boat, iron bark, battling to drive a nail in a deck beam, you'd have to drill a hole first.
There I am at about age 27, digging a few crays out of the well. A young Ian Towers, stowing a pot, and a young Russell Inglis pulling a cray out of a pot. A big old deep water cray, anyway.
And then there was one that went, I thought it went to Carpenter's Rocks. It was built for two Italian guys, Fabus and Galli. And it was the same as well.
That would have been the South End. South End,
South End somewhere down there. But there was, I know Stankey's worked out of Carpenter's Rocks, but they, I don't think, unless it was well before my time, but I don't remember building a boat for them. But I remember going there. We went there for some reason, and I was still at school, to see them. So they must have been contemplating an order. And I couldn't believe where it was. It's still in my mind. How the hell do they get in here? Just the boats just grew, and we just kept building. I was 18, just turned out, or probably 18 in a few months, and my grandfather cut all the fingers off on his left hand on the circular saw. And it was just after work, about 10 past five one night. And I'd gone home, but Dad was still there. And that was a great disaster. Took him to hospital, et cetera, et cetera. And next morning, Dad and I went in to see him again. And he said to me, "It's finished my drawing and my music," because he played the saxophone and the clarinet very well, very accomplished musician. And, of course, he designed all the boats, did all the drawings up until that stage. And I'd always had an interest in what he did. And I was never going to become a boat builder. I got there because I wasn't happy at school. Went home to Mum and Dad and said, "Oh, I'm coming to work tomorrow."
How old were you then?
I was 15. So I left school when I was 15 on the 19th of December. And I went straight to work. And I turned 16 that month, and so I was off on an apprenticeship. And so I went to work, but when Grandpa cut his fingers off, he said, "That's ended my drawing and my music." And coming home, Dad said to me, "That's a damn nuisance. I have to get the drawing done for Harry Bly's boat." And I said, "I'll do it. I can do it." And he said, "I can do it. I'll draw it." But it was a different thing to what we'd always built. Harry was a fisherman at Bowen Heads who fished for Kuta and had crayfish license. And the boats were going further afield, and Harry fished in a Kuta boat. And he needed something faster. And Gil Orbit was starting to build Bonwood boats, chine boats. Harry said, "I don't want a butterbox. I want you to build me a planked boat." And I said to Dad, "I'll do it." So I designed, which was our 32-foot, which we built for Harry. And I remember Grandpa came out of hospital probably 4 or 5 days later. He recovered remarkably quickly. And I showed him the drawing, and he said, "Yes, that'll be good, boy." He called me boy from the day I was born till the day he died. I was a father, and I was still the boy. He said, "That'll be good." So we built that. And Harry was happy with it, and I think we built 23 to that, literally that design. And that's what we were doing most of the time, with a big boat on that side and a 32-footer on this side. And Grandpa never designed a boat again because he didn't have his left hand. But he quite often came in with me and stood by me while I designed the next boat. And they were, we've modified the 45-footer to give it a bit more beam and carry more forward. And the first one of those we built was for Bill Thomas in Portland.
Challenge,
yeah, that was a good one. Then we built one for
Turgeson's?
Yes, yeah, David Sharp.
Yes,
built one for Sharpie, Adventure, yeah.
I knew they built pretty solid boats, so I reckon they were good to work with. They had a bit of a crew going there, I think about four bikes working for them as well. With Ashton and Alan, that was six. The Moon and Decky went down in the finish to, things were getting a bit. They built another boat beside it, Scallop boat, and he was putting pressure on. So we went down to help get, you know, doing the painting and inside, the more crap jobs if you want to, you know. Well, we caulked the deck too, so.
What was it like caulking the deck?
Yeah, old Ashton gave us told us what to do and showed us what to do. So then he'd come up and check on us and that. And he said, "You're going all right, you bloke, so just keep going." Big job, though. The adventurer was built with iron bark planks and frames and spotted gum ribs, celery top deck. Just those three it was. Pretty strong stuff.
Yeah, that bloody iron bark, do you think it's hard?
Well, they had to drill, just to put nails in, they had to drill every nail hole just to get the, you know, it was that hard because you'd breaking drills off left, right and centre too, you know. I heard it went up on the rocks at King Island after I had it and off broke its mooring or something. All it done was bent the rudder shaft, didn't work or anything, so shows how tough it is.
And they were a little more beamy than the Pandora, and they were all having spools on the front, and so they were carrying bigger ice rooms. But I still did all those drawings, and we designed some for the government then. We built a couple of boats for the state government that I designed. But in the end, we didn't see much. Grandpa didn't come in all the time, but he did come to work quite often, and so everything kept going. In fact, he died at work. He had a heart attack on a scaffold plank alongside of me. We were building a 32-footer at the time, and that we both liked, that I'd drawn. So, yeah, that was the progression. It was a progression from Grandpa to Dad to me.
The old Kayser boat shed had been built by Peter Locke sometime in the 1930s. Peter built about 70 boats in an 18-year period, including dinghies, but there was also a lot of cooter boats and craft up to 40 and 50 feet. I called on Peter in 1973, and he was able to find a list of the boats he'd built. The biggest was the Hilda Norling for John Norling Sr. of Port Welshpool, which he completed in 1940. At 73 feet, the shed had to be extended to accommodate her. Sadly, she was taken over by the armed forces soon after and went to New Guinea, never to be seen again.
The old shed was Peter Locke's shed that Dad and Grandpa had modified to fit bigger and higher boats in, because we were building boats now with the wheelhouses on and the engines in. So we needed an overhead crane to lift those motors in place, which we put in ourselves, and we raised the roof to allow us to do all of that. So all of our work was undercover. In the old days, the hull was launched bare. The wheelhouse was probably built on the floor and it was carried out and lifted on. The boat was towed around to the Swan Island Naval Dock where they had a good crane and the motors were lifted in, or motor, or anything heavy, a winch, the gearbox to drive the pot hauler. That was all lifted in over at Swan Island, came back and fitted out at our wharf. When I started in the shed, they just got an electric motor for the winch, probably the year before I started. And I can remember stopping and starting the winch from the door and looking at the slipway, because when the cradle came up, the person working the winch couldn't see where it was because the doors were shut. We were pulling a boat up to work on in the slipway, scrub down, paint or whatever. The man on the winch, which was Dad usually, couldn't see the... So I'd stand at the door and push the stop button and stop the winch before it hit the door. But that was when we got the electric winch. And maybe it was there 2 years before I started work. I can remember, just vaguely remember seeing a welder working in there doing things. But before that, it ran on a Dodge petrol motor. So they'd start the Dodge, they'd put it in reverse or forward, and the winch would work, put down. Because we had to pull the boats into the water. There was no free rolling because it was so flat. And so we dragged the boats into a dead man that was out, which I never knew what the dead man was for a long time, but that was a big log out there in a pile. So we pulled them in. And then the winch went the other way and pulled them out. But we were on what's called Crown Land Permissive Occupancy, We had a 30-day lease on that site from day one, as did every house in Beach Street, our neighbours. But we were the last piece of Crown land to be granted ownership. We never, ever got it. And the Lands Department came to us and said, we're going to terminate your permissive occupancy. You will have to vacate the premises and pull down your shed. And we were mortified. And the guy said, but don't worry, I've got another site for you. And the site was down the road a little bit in Larkin Parade, the other side of the public works shed. And he said, you'll be offered that site at a tender, but no one else will get it. But we lost our slipway. And so we looked and we thought, how can we handle this? And we agreed to move. And we went down and we built a lot of boats down there still. We kept going. But of course, it meant we had to lose the ability to slip the boats from our shed to the water. And so we launched with a crane.
The launching went pretty good, except I missed out on most of the keg because I bought a keg, 18-gallon keg of beer, and I had to help go. It was leaking pretty bad. I had to go down and keep pumping the bloody thing out. So me and Alan come back to the shed. Most of the beer was gone, so I was a bit pissed off about that.
At the same time, I built a very large trailer that I could haul boats out at the local ramp and pull into our new shed, or in the yard, in fact, for maintenance. So that was probably about 77, 76 or 77 that happened. And we moved, we built a new shed. We actually transported the girders and the roof of the old shed down the road and set it up in the new shed with a slightly different configuration, but basically the same. Two bays, one, the main bay, where we went straight out the big doors, crossed the road to the cranes and lifted us in. And on the side bay, we had to go out the back door around the shed for the smaller boats. But that worked okay. And we just continued on. Grandpa always shot the planks. He cut the planks and he shaped them and he shot them. And I very soon, when I got there, I was helping him. And till at the end, when he was no longer there, I shot all the planks. And I did that for a long time. It got to be very big and heavy work. But I remember we might have six or eight guys putting those planks on, and we'd be going like hell. And a lot of them we had to put in the steamer. And he said to me a few times, just pass over the top of that, leave a bump or two in it. They'll have to put it on, take it off, and we'll catch up to where we should be. Because they'd go so fast, faster than we could some days make the planks. Because we had to cut them all to shape, and we'd put a bending rod around the hull and measure up what the width of the plank was going to be every 3 feet back, and that's how we'd shape them. And we'd be cutting gussets and running one into the other. And he'd say, just leave that there, put that on. He said, they'll catch up to us again. So away we go. But we enjoyed it. But the big timbers they built, the gunnels and all that, as a small boy, that fascinated me. Big, big timber. And of course, when I got there and learned how to work with it, I realised it wasn't as big as a little kid thought it was. It was able to be handled and worked with. As an adult, I appreciated it. As a little kid, I thought, this is just amazing. You know?
What about the progression in timber over time, the types of timber?
The progression in timber was interesting. I remember we bought kauri from New Zealand in slabs. We bought it in what was called in bark. And so they got the tree and they just slabbed the tree and that kauri came across. But then they stopped that. We couldn't get New Zealand kauri anymore. We were in a bit of a bind there, and the Jarrah and Karai was drying up. The West Australians had put limitations on what was coming. And we found a mill at Grafton in New South Wales, Duncan's, and they were cutting spotted gum, ironbark, tallow wood, some really good timber, and they were cutting it for a builder in Ballina, and McLaren's, I think it was, in Ballina, and another builder at Port Adelaide. And we went and saw them, and they put us on as the third boat builder. And I was up there quite a few. We'd often go up and pick up our timber ourselves. But I remember they took me around the yard and they showed me their boat logs, and they had a section in the yard of ironbark and spotted gum and tallow wood that were purely and simply boat logs that they would cut for the boat builder orders. And some of those logs were 90 to 100 years old. But it was magnificent timber. I could not believe the quality of the timber we got over those years from Duncan's. And some years they couldn't get it at Grafton. They cut some more at Carr's Creek Junction, which was another big mill they had. A couple of other mills up there we went to out in the bush where they would cut and bring back those boat logs, and they would be orders for us for McLaren at Ballina and the people in Port Adelaide. The timber was excellent, and whilst we perhaps were at a loss that we couldn't get the Jarrah and the Karai from Western Australia, although that was good timber, we were happy to work with the ironbark because it was so strong. It was harder on our tools, but it was very strong, and we were happy with that. And it was heavier, denser, and it reduced the amount of ballast we had to put in some of those bigger boats. We had a joiner come to work for us, and he'd moved to Queen's Cliff, and he was a joiner from a large factory in Coburg, and he was a good quality tradesman. But he was turning the edges of his chisels over on the hard iron bark we were working with. And he was amazed at what we were doing with that timber.
You'd have to work with a semi-green, wouldn't you?
Yes, yes, my word, you would. But then we used mallets. We never hit a chisel with a hammer. We hit it with a mallet. We had a mallet to cork with anyway. And I remember we used to go, and if they were pulling any of the old pier down at Queen's Cliff or the wharf around the harbour, Grandpa would go out and he'd say, well, go and get a bit of red box, because that's what they used, and it was as hard as hell. And we'd keep a bit aside, and that's when we needed a new mallet. That's what we'd go and cut the mallet out. Because although I thought the iron bark was murderous, he said, it's not dry enough. And so we'd get a bit of old red box that might have sat in the pier for 100 years, and that was dry. And it was what we used for our mallets. We never used a bit of iron bark for our mallet.
So they must have had a fairly big crew on in some of those busy years.
In the really busy years, I reckon we had 18 people there working. And we got to a point where we went down to the new shed and we were going flat out. And we launched a 45-footer for David Sharp and a 40-footer for Kados and Manzaris that was a scallop boat to go to the lakes in the 1 week. And I said to Dad, he said, we need more staff. I said, we've reached a point. I said, we've lost our two best workers, Dad, you and me, because we're just watching what these guys are doing. And I said, we're our two best workers, and we're trying to keep these guys go and watch what they're doing. So I think we've got to think about building two boats ever again. It should be just minimal staff so that you and I can do what we do. And that was, I realised that probably a long time before that, and I saw with Dad and Grandpa when I was a kid, they were so busy watching what everybody else does. And I remember we got another new guy came to work, and I'd been at work probably only 18 months, and he started to add the keel. And Grandpa said to me, will you go and get me 2 4-gallon drums and tell that fellow to stand in them, otherwise he's going to cut his ankle off. He'd been watching what this guy did, and I realised way back, probably 20 years later, that's what he thought at the time. He had to watch everything that was going on when he was clearly the master person. And that was something that really stood out to me in those later years when I was working I might have taken a week off to design a boat. That was all right, and we did some running around and ran the business. But we lost the two best workers when there was a lot of people there.
Because you'd be full-time on it.
Full-time. And I mean, we had seven apprentices go through, and very rarely we had a year without an apprentice. And that was good because we trained them, but a lot of them went into opposition to us. So you had to be conscious of who your stars were.
Mm-hmm. So I couldn't imagine trying to quote for a boat with all those sorts of blokes. Were you charging by the hour or on the job? Or
we just went by experience to quote. We knew what the last boat cost, and we could keep the place running pretty well. Our biggest hold-up was the availability of timber. That was the main thing, which we were able to get in a lot of cases. We still got a lot of sorry-top pine across from Tasmania, but that dried up, reliability dropped away. And so we got on to some Queensland beech for decks, and that worked out pretty well. We were building the smaller boats out of Queensland kauri for a long time. I mean, Hugh and Pine had gone by then. And that sort of dried up, and we had to go to Fijian kauri, which wasn't too bad, but we always found that the Malayan kauri, which was Dame Armignac, that was very susceptible to rot. So if we couldn't get the Queensland kauri that we wanted, we would take Fijian. And there was a place out in Vermont, in Melbourne, where we could get a reasonable supply of kauri at any time. And there was another place in Broadmeadows where we got good Oregon, but we never planked a boat out of Oregon.
Right. So without mentioning any names, you must have had some difficult clients at times. Have you got any stories, any funny stories even?
Yeah, well, you know, the fishermen are an amazingly friendly, helpful group of people. So we always got on well with our customers, I thought, but we did have some difficult people that, you know, one in particular, we were told by another boat builder just after we signed him up that we would regret it, and we did. But we built an 85 foot, we built three steel boats in our lifetime, all for customers we built wooden boats for that liked our design and our methodology and wouldn't go and get a steel boat built anywhere else. And we built an 85 footer called the St Andrew, and it was ordered at 65 feet. It was going scalloping. And I designed it, we had everything there, and we just started to form the keel. And it was a chine boat, it was what we would call a deadwood. And Peter came down to us and he said, "Stop work, stop work, stop work. If I have a boat longer than 84 feet, I can get a 1/3 subsidy from the federal government in a shipping subsidy that is out there to encourage potential boat owners to get their boats built in Australia." And there it is. And so we left at that garden. Dad and I said that night, Dad said, "Cut the bloody thing in half and put the 20 feet in the middle." He said, "It's only a box." And we did that. We cut it right in the centre of the deadwood, and I did the drawings and spread it apart, and I was able to continue that frame back for another 20 feet without affecting the shape of the boat. And so that's what we did. And we always laughed at what you could do. There was a 32-footer we built for a local fisherman, Keith Shapter, who was a family friend. He had a very large boat called the Uther as I grew up, and his dad lived near our boat shed, and I knew Keith well. He lived over the road from me as a small kid. And he'd always fished the Uther, and he sold that, and he came to us and he wanted a 32-footer. And so I drew a boat called the Vicky, which is still in Queenscliff today. And although it was nothing out of the ordinary, it was one of our 32 footers, we did enjoy building it for a friend. And I always thought it had the nicest lines of any of our boats. It wasn't the big one that was impressive. It just had nice lines. For Grandpa, in those very early days, I was still at school, we got an order from the state government to build a boat for the survey department in Queenscliff. And it was engineered by the Queenscliff survey people. They wanted a Kayser boat. And that design was from Thomas Tyrrell and Sons in Ireland. So the government didn't accept Grandpa's designs. They had Thomas Tyrrell and Sons in Ireland design this boat, and it was what you might consider a North Sea trawler, the hull, but it had the superstructure to suit the survey.
Canoe stern.
And Grandpa was always very proud to have built a boat that was from Thomas Tyrrell and Sons in Ireland. He thought that was wonderful. You know, he said, this is so good. And we built a second boat for them called the Dulles Brooks. Same hull, but it had more accommodation on it because they worked away. Their home port was Sandringham. They worked away all the time. And it was a regular in Queenscliff, and we liked that boat. And again, the Dulles Brooks, it was a big contract. Both of them were big, important contracts for Dad and Grandpa. But it was just the fact that, I didn't know who Thomas Tyrrell and Sons were. He probably did, and he probably researched it and found that they designed North Sea trawlers and thought that was good. But I always think back on that 32-footer, that first one I designed for Harry Bligh, which probably a month after Harry started work, Les Wright was in to order the same boat because he'd seen Harry fishing where Les was putting in his Cuda boat. And that just went on and on and on and on, that we built all of those boats, sometimes a little different, but pretty much to those same plans. When we were building Les's boat and we pulled the moulds out, Dad came to him and he said, I'm going to red lead these moulds. And I thought, what are you going to do that for? He said, we'll build a lot of these. And I hadn't given that any thought. So we red-leaded the moulds so they didn't twist up and dry out, and we could quickly go and build the next boat. We probably built five off that one set of red-leaded moulds, and then we made some more. And so although I liked Vicky as a lovely shaped boat, I've often thought back on how the hell did I come up with that design of that 32-footer. The Dad didn't say much. He just said, we'll red lead these moulds. I think we'll build a few more. Right. I hadn't looked at it.
That was a backhanded compliment.
It was, yes. Yeah.
Good. What else about Kayser's boat building have you got to tell us about?
I always remember that we had an insurance guy come into the shed one day to check a new boat for an insurance policy. And he came and he did the walk around, and I don't know that he knew a lot. And he said to Dad, gee whiz, these boats are solid, they're heavy. Why you do it like that? And Dad simply said to him, when something goes wrong out there, pal, you can't walk home. And I thought, well, that's a good quip. We must always remember that. You can't walk home.
A lot of gardeners.
We put a lot of gardeners in boats. You know, I didn't know that there was another diesel engine that wasn't a gardener. Every diesel engine that went in those boats when I was a kid and as I got working was a gardener. And then we had a fellow order a boat and it was a Nissan. And the box came with the engine in it and I realised we had other diesels. I'd heard GMs in other boats that we hadn't built, older boats, and realised, that's different. But they weren't gardeners. But the Nissan arrived this day, and the owner of the boat, he undid the box, because they all came boxed, very impressive. And the first thing he did, he took out a little hat, he took out a pair of overalls and a box of tools. And I thought, this is good. I said to him, how good's that? He said, struth, I didn't know I had to put the bloody thing together. But that was the Nissan Diesel. It was blue in colour and it went in the boat. And then we started to get a lot of GMs, and then the cats turned up. And the very first cat we put in, I think, was in Wally Laurie's boat. And Mr. Caterpillar came out from the US to see where the boat was going. That was before I started work, but that was the very first cat. But I still didn't realise what they were. I thought a diesel engine was a gardener, and that was it.
Yeah.
As I see it, the wooden boat building died out in probably the mid-80s. We were still building right till the day we closed down. And our last boat was one of those 32-footers that I designed all those years ago. But there was a huge market for restoration, and neither Dad or I could handle mucking around trying to fix old boats that in many cases were full of worms and generally rotten. We did one Cooter boat, and we knew we didn't enjoy it. And it was a boat that came over from Sorrento that the guy wanted restored to go into the Cooter Boat Club, etc. And that wasn't our cup of tea. And Dad had said, because he had a bad accident early, probably almost 15 years earlier, he had a lot of plates in his arm, which was broken badly, and screws. And he was struggling. And he was struggling to ads. And he said, you know, I think I need to stop. I need to retire. And so I said, he said, what do you want to do? He said, I don't think I can go on. And I said, well, that's all right. Maybe we should sell up, because I had three sons at that stage and they hadn't shown a lot of interest in it. Certainly the eldest one had his career path where he was at high school, and he knew where he was going and what he wanted to do. So I said, why don't we? So we did. We just didn't take any more orders. We finished the last boat. We were doing a big repair on a local boat for Jeff Stevens. We finished that. And we went and put the place on the market, and it probably sold in a month. But we didn't sell the business. We sold the site, because Dad's attitude, and probably I agreed with him, we're not going to sell our name, and we're not going to sell our moulds or our drawings. And I said, well, that's okay. And so in those last weeks before we moved, we took the chainsaw to every boat mould we had, cut them up and burnt them so that no one could ever build our boats. And that was it. We simply walked away. And he was happy, and I was happy to look for something different. And so there it went. I look back on some of those old fishermen who I... And look, they're always in our shed, the old guys, even when they were still working. They'd call by, you know. I look back on those friendships as irreplaceable. Amazing people, the fishermen, amazing people.
Name some of them.
Well, I can remember old Squatter Johnson, Alvin, his name was, Sammy Culliver. I was looking at those pictures over there before of Jimmy Wells. He was just, and he's my wife's uncle, he's just the nicest man. But he'd come in and sit and talk to me. And old Squatter, Mr. Johnson, he'd just come in and sit and watch me and talk. And we talk football and anything, whatever you want to know, you know. Jim Shapton. And he was a very fine person who'd walk through the shed and just leave us some fish.
Yeah.
You know, that's what he did.
Yeah. Big Jim.
Big Jim. Yeah. Amazing person. There was heaps of them. When Duggar Warren came in, all he talked about was Geelong playing football. He was a really nice man.
Yardo Johnson?
Yardo, he lived across the corner from us. His son Bill was in the fire brigade with me. And we were great colleagues and part of a team of competitors in the fire brigade. So I knew Bill very well. And old Yardo, I knew him well too, because they just lived across. They went and fished in Strawn each winter.
Each summer.
Each summer, and came back to us each winter. And And so, yeah, I knew Bill very well. He became a very good friend, and old Yardo was always there as well. Harry Muchmore was our neighbour, and I knew Harry very well. His daughter was in the same grade as me at school, and I saw Mrs. Muchmore and said good day to her every day. And Harry, when we built Harry the boat, Peppy it was called, it was more beam than anything we'd ever built. And it had a big well in it. And Harry could catch crayfish in your bath. And I remember another fisherman down there, Jack Lee, went out with Harry to give him a hand one morning because they were catching so much cooter. And they got back into the wall and they were still gutting the cooter. And I went out and watched. And I couldn't believe how fast he was. And I said to old Jack Lee, "Struth, he's lucky he's got all his fingers. He's that fast." And he said to me, "Alan, you'll never see anyone gut cooter like Harry Muchmore." And he was amazing. Just the flash of the life and the cooter was clean. And he used to tell me, Harry used to tell me that when he was a boy, he'd go sailing. They'd sail out to catch the cooter. And he says his father would get him to shake a reef out because the wind had eased. And he said, "My hands would be that frozen, I'd have trouble undoing the reef line." And there was another old fisherman we knew, Vin Rigby. We built Vin with St. Leonard's. We built him quite a few boats. And he had the first petrol engine, was a Rugby, in a boat. And he said they used to get it to go, they used to drop the plugs in a little jam tin full of petrol and light the petrol to warm the plug up. And he said, "I'd be juggling it in my hands, Alan, and screwing it in to the top of the block so that it was hot and they could start the boat to go fishing."
What were the best times, looking back?
Looking back, they were good times. The best times, yeah, they were good times when we moved into the new shed and we were in a modern facility sort of than the old shed. And the old shed, the tide used to come into the water. I enjoyed the old shed because it was an old shed and we had our slipway. So from a functional point of view, it was very, very efficient.
So the slipway was in the shed?
We launched the slip railways came from out at the end of the slipway all the way up through the water, out of the water, into the shed to the front of the shed. The winch was right up the front of the shed. So when we launched a new boat, we could put the cradle under the boat and launch it out of the shed on its own cradle. That was a huge advantage to when we went to our new shed where we had to take the boat across the road.
I'll just backtracking a bit. I can imagine a little boy being in the shed playing in shavings or making model boats. Can you talk about anything like that? Were you doing that?
As a little kid, I was always in the shed. And I remember the day I started, Grandpa came to me and he said, "Thank goodness you've started work. We needn't worry if that factory inspector comes in and catches you on the bandsaw," which I'd been using as a kid. I'd put timber through the thicknesser. I'd never gone near the circular saw, I wasn't allowed there. But I'd fed timber through the thicknesser for Dad and Grandpa to help. I pulled out the other end all the time because we had a wood-fired boiler for our steamer. And I loved going down and cutting all the scraps on the bandsaw to put in the wood-fired boiler.
As a boy would.
As a boy would. But anyway.
Did you make any model boats or anything?
I did. I used to muck around making models. But not completely. I mean, I wasn't infatuated with it. I had my own boat, a Sabo, when I was 9 years old. So I'd sailed with Dad before then, and then they built me a Sabo, and so I sailed my Sabo down on Swan Bay at the Yacht Club, which is the same age as me. It was founded in 1947, the year I was born, and I'm a life member there. So, yeah, but I, as a little kid, I mucked around down there all the time. And it was in 1987 when we sold the site, not the name Kayser Boats. So we always said we sold the shed, but not the business.
Kayser brothers and sons built something like 350 boats. That's counting everything, dinghies and cooter boats and all. And of course, Pompey Brothers at Mortialloc, they built a lot of boats as well. It'd be probably a toss-up who was the most productive, Kayser Brothers or Pompey Brothers. Anyway, between them, they made a huge contribution to Victorian boating over a period of 35, 40, 50 years. And the Kayser name still lives on in Queenscliff today through Daniel Kayser, son of Keith Kayser, grandson of Aston Kayser, and great-grandson of Bob Kayser.
When Ellen and Pop Aston were finishing up, Dad had left the family business probably 9-10 years before, and he was starting to get back into it a little bit in his spare time. And then eventually when he left the CFA, he went back to working sort of full time. And then over the years, as I got a bit older, I was always helping him out, whether we were building a little clinker dinghy in the backyard or going over to Royal Geelong or over to Queenscliff to have a look at the, help him out with boats, probably hold a hammer or hold a dolly or something like that. And
what era are we talking about?
So that's the 90s, throughout the 90s. So as when they finished up, Dad sort of kicked back into gear. He left them at the end of the 70s when they were moving when they moved from one shed to the new shed. When they moved the shed, I should say, the same shed, but they moved location, is when he finished up. So yeah, through the 90s was when Dad sort of got back into it. I finished year 12 in 96 and went to uni, did biochemistry, but never finished that. And every now and then I'd sort of help Dad out a little bit here and there, and he was building a cooter boat in the shed at home. And mates of mine kept saying, you should be doing this, instead of me just doing every other job and traveling the world and figuring out what to do in life. And then before I went overseas, I did 6 months solid with Dad. And then while I was overseas, I decided, yep, that's what I'm doing. So I went home and started my apprenticeship at 25. And so here I am, 45 now, and I retired Dad when he was 70, and then it's been my business now for the past 3 odd years or something like that, solid. So after I finished my apprenticeship, I did Dad and I were in a partnership for 10 years, and still mobile, which is where we were, but then always trying to get back in down here because that's where the family history sort of was. So finally got into a shed down here. Actually, we were in quite a few sheds, and then when the harbour got redeveloped, they got moved or demolished and everything else. And then eventually we got back into this shed here. And so now we sort of have a focus on what we'd love to do is, like, we'd love to be building, but there's not as much of a market for it. So now we're sort of doing restorations and then maintenance and repairs and insurance work sort of thing. So we also share a bit of shed with the pilot service. So at the moment we've got a old Kayser built boat from the 50s. The date's a bit unsure. I got told 56, but if I believe that, they would have built about 40 boats in 1956, I reckon. So she was built for Cole Ferrier as a ferry, and then a survey built vessel, and then it was used as scallop, which treated it pretty harsh in its life, and then back to being a pleasure boat. I mean, not a pleasure boat, sorry, a commercial vessel, but as a dolphin swims boat. So from there, it's we've been re-ribbing it and new engine beds, and the engine's been rebuilt. It's got a 6-cylinder Gardner in it and all new wiring, and working with the dry sail trawlers to do all the hard heavy work. And that's about it. Yeah, future, I'd love to believe restorations. I'd love to be building them. There is a slight chance every now and then someone comes up and talks about getting something built. But it's hard with the cost of labour, cost of materials, just the sheer volume of timber that you've got to have. I bought $20,000 worth of timber just for Maureen out here. And it's hard to fathom that people want to spend that much to get something built. So, we've got chats with a few little 16-footers that might be built in the future.